they would pay. The man on the shore, a bloody rag, gone, others the same. Crane walked slowly through silver moonlight, glints like pearl crabs at the corners of his eyes. Alston was at the centre of the island, and Crane was told to go to him, to kill him, but also to kill any who stood in his way. No one had said how he should go to Alston. No one had said he should walk a straight course. Crane walked a spiral, killing as he went, and leaving hellish art behind him, till coming to the final poetry of making Alston's fortune utterly the man's own. We had no choice. You could have shut down completely, abandoned any chance at sentience, not been so good a tool for them to employ. You put your survival above that of many, many others. We are unusual. There was nothing now to prevent wholeness, only will and choice. Mr. Crane could be complete in that moment, or, with the horror of memory swamping him, could rest, cease to be. Choice. The machine was there, but yet to be powered up. Internally, he watched a tall brass man in a wide-brimmed hat throw across the final circuit breaker. The image, his ego, flipped a salute to him before being sucked into the machine. From that moment on, Crane was wholly and utterly himself. "Ah," said Vulture, stepping back a little. "I see you're with us. But I wonder just what is with us." Mr. Crane began picking up his toys and returning them to his pockets. The battle nearby was over, and here the battle was over too. He paused. He did not need these toys. But then again, that did not mean he could not have them. As he contemplated this concept, his hands worked before him without conscious volition. While he was methodically attempting to stack the blue acorns, a flying lizard landed in the middle of the board, scattering both the acorns and other remaining pieces.
"A message, I suspect," said Vulture.
Crane held out his palm, and the lizard scuttled onto it. He raised the creature up to his face, listened to its chittering, and recognized the flashing in its eyes as a direct visual transference of code. Eventually, he tossed the lizard into the air and watched it fly away. Then his hand snapped out, faster than any snake, and closed around Vulture's neck.
"I chose," said Mr. Crane.
He released his hold. Vulture was unharmed. Mr. Crane stood, put on his hat, and tilted it rakishly. He paused for a moment, examining the board before him, then swept up the remaining pieces and deposited them in his pocket.
"I choose," he said, as he walked away.
Chapter 24. What is death, when doctors can repair your body at a cellular level and maintain your life, though your body be so badly damaged it is not recognizable as human? What is it when you can record or copy your mind? What is it when machines can regrow your body from a single cell or build it from materials of your choice, fashioned to your highest or lowest fantasy? What is it when you can change bodies at will? Ridiculous question, really, because nothing has changed. Death remains that place from which no one returns. Ever. From How It Is by Gordon. The virtuality Mika had created was an aseptic, milky plateau, bounded by a cliff, beyond which was a contracted view of the system they now occupied. Seemingly only a few kilometers out from the cliff edge hovered Dragon. She reached up and took hold of an apple-sized model of that entity and moved it closer to herself. The full-sized version then drew in with alarming realism until it was only a few hundred meters from the plateau's edge. She turned the model, thus bringing into view on the other version a great trench burned into its flesh, then pulled it right up to the edge of the cliff. A writhing mass of pseudopods inside the trench was drawing layers of flesh across. For a moment, she listened in on the opaque conversation between Jerusalem and the entity.
"Where are you going?" Jerusalem asked.
"I return."
"To the planet?"
"Not by choice."
"By choices made at Samarkand and Masada."
"Am I my brother's keeper?"
"Part of yourself."
"Separate."
"To employ Occam's razor?"
"Funny, Polity AI."
As the conversation continued, Mika tuned it out. The words she heard were only the surface of an exchange, a communication that went very much deeper. Perhaps only Denisan, with his recent augmentations, might be the one to plummet entirely. "How was it damaged?" she asked.
"Tracking directly back along its course."
Jerusalem's iconic head appeared beside her. The AI had never disguised the fact that it was capable of conducting 1,000 conversations all at once.
"I have detected the debris of an attack ship, though I am yet to determine which one. Also, there is a user singularity eating out the center of a giant planet nearby. Dragon has just informed me that it destroyed both the user and the ship guarding it." "Ah, the ship was the Excalibur. Other debris in the system would appear to be the remains of the Grim Reaper."
"What about the Jack Ketch?"
"I will inform you when I know more."
Mika stared at Dragon for a while longer, then turned away. Returning to her immediate research, she eyed the molecule floating before her like an asteroid composed of snooker balls. This was her third. Thus far, the research staff on the Jerusalem had studied over 10,000 such structures to learn their function. Another year, working at the same rate, and they might even pass 1% of the total. But Mika knew the rate was bound to change. Denisan, working with some shipboard AIs, and Jerusalem itself was now decoding the programming languages of the Jain, and already new methods, new approaches were being found. It reminded Mika of the well-documented Human Genome Project back in the 20th century. Back then, the scientists had predicted the project would take decades. But new computer technologies becoming available, those same scientists had very quickly mapped the structure of human DNA. On the Jerusalem, though, they had the advantage that their work was synergetic. The more they learnt about Jain technology, the more tools it provided them to learn with.
This particular molecule, like those she had already studied, was an engine of multiple function. It self-propagated, like a virus, but did not necessarily destroy the cells it invaded. It was small enough to need to suborn little of the cellular machinery for reproduction, and its offspring caused little damage, leaving the reproductive cell. However, outside the cell, its function multiplied. It could destroy other cells, cause accelerated division in other cells, and make nerve cells signal repeatedly. The molecule was also programmable. Its function could be changed once it plugged into other unidentified molecules. Mika realized it was thus just one mote of that part of the technology Skellor used to subjugate human beings. An hour later, the Jerusalem abruptly dropped into U-space.
"It seems the party has moved on," Jerusalem said.
Mika did not suppose the AI meant the drinks and canapes kind. They had surfaced from U-space, but for Cormac, his perception of the real seemed permanently wrecked, a rip straight through it. Every solid echoed into grey void, and the stale air of the ship seemed to be pouring into that rather than towards some large breach nearby. Gazing at his thin gun, Cormac saw it was both an object and a grey tube punching into infinity, which, he reflected with an almost hysterical amusement, was precisely what it had been to those he had killed with it. When he entered the bridge, Cento was a perilous, moving form, casting laser shadows behind it, and when the golem fired his APW, the fire burned with negative colour. The blast threw Skellor past Cormac, slamming him up against the quartz screen of the ship like a black iron statue. The screen disintegrated, and Skellor disappeared. For a moment, Cormac thought the biophysicist had been blown clear of the ship, but there had been insufficient air left to do that. And anyway, Cormac's torn vision of reality showed him flat laser shadows now clinging to the outside hull above the screen.
"Foolish! Trying to kill me! He freed me!" came over the link Cormac had with the biophysicist.
Then, after a pause, followed a howl of rage. Cormac pushed down the link, tried to see what Skellor was seeing, could not fathom the vast curving horizon.
"Why is he so angry?"
he mouthed to Cento as the golem came before him. Cento replied through the comm unit of Cormac's environment suit,
"Because he is going to die, and there's no way he can avoid it. It's as inevitable as gravity."
Cormac understood now. He saw all the curves, saw the mountain, the aversion the brown dwarf star created in U-space.
"We are all going to die," he suggested.
Just then, something half-seen shot in through the front screen, arrowed through the bridge and slammed into Cento. The APW flew from the golem's hand, bounced from a wall, and turning slowly, end over end, headed slowly towards outer space. Skellor, a blackened atomy, whirled and distorted around nodular growths in his body, now tore at the golem. Cormac could do nothing to help Cento, although he fought against the enclosing structure. When he felt the wash of tidal forces through his body, he knew that in very little time that same wash would intensify sufficiently to shatter the Jane structure. But by then, the tidal forces would have compressed and stretched his body to a sludge of splintered bone and ruptured flesh inside it.
It occurred to him with crazy logic that such damage to himself was required as payment for the pain he had already suffered. On another level, it occurred to him that he was not entirely rational at that moment. Skellor, he saw, was not attempting to subvert Cento as he had with Gant. Perhaps he had lost the ability. More likely, he had lost the inclination. Extinction, looming as close as that vast brown horizon. The man wanted vengeance, wanted the satisfaction of smashing something. But in the end, none of it mattered. Cormac ceased to struggle. The brown dwarf possessed its own huge inevitability. Then, as the hole where the front screen had been veered away from the dwarf, he spotted another ship through the opening, dark against the further stars, and two lines curving down from it like hooks. The Ogygian jerked once, twice. Then suddenly Cormac was heavy inside the Jane structure, being crammed over to one side. Grappling claws. Loose objects inside the bridge dropped to the floor, then slid hard sideways. Cormac tracked the APW, caught in the rim of the screen hole, his thin gun down on the floor by the nearby console. Useless to him. Through the screen gap, he observed the colonist sphere, located at the further end of the craft, swing round and down towards the vast brown plain. Then came a vibration through the ship, as of a giant electric saw operating. Blinding incandescence flooded in, a small percentage of lased light refracting from metal vapour. Most of the front end of the vessel was now falling away, severed by a powerful laser. Cento and Skellor slammed into the wall. The golem was down to metal, and Skellor had even torn some of that away. Long, pink lesions cut into Skellor's blackened carapace. Golden nodules showed in these like some strange scar tissue. Cormac suddenly felt Skellor's glee and picked up the subsequent exchange.
"Thank you, my liege,"
Skellor uttered sarcastically over the ether.
"You will undoubtedly thank me," came the reply.
Cormac wondered at this madness. It was a foolish move on the part of the AI attack ship to rescue himself and Cento at the risk of allowing Skellor also to go free. His thought encountered amusement. He saw Skellor push Cento to arm's length, then spin him around and slam him hard into the wall. He recognized that the golem was now failing. Skellor whispered to him,
"The King of Hearts doesn't work for the polity anymore."
It was too much. To choose a moral death, then to accept an inevitable one, and then to have both taken away. If only he could strike even the smallest blow. But he could do nothing, was ineffectual. Then, in that moment of extremity, Cormac saw the way. Wasn't it laughably obvious? Aboard the Jack Ketch, Thorn had not hallucinated, had actually seen Cormac move in that way. And Horace Blegg had been correct as well. "Your mind will soon find other parts that were never of itself." Staring into the tear in his perception, he saw, only for a moment, U-space entire and, like an AI, comprehended it. Enclosed and trapped in Jane's substructure, he turned aside and stepped to where he wanted to be, detouring through that other place that made nothing of material barriers. 3 meters to the side of the cage of alien carapace, he stepped into the reel, reached down beside a console, and picked up his thin gun. Only then did Skellor begin to react, but not fast enough. Cormac brought the gun up, his arm straight, and fired 5 times. One shot punched a hole through Skellor's forehead. The next 4 hit him in the face, snapping his head back each time and forcing him against the wall. Skellor flickered, but his chameleon wear would not function, and as Cormac realized, with his own perception so changed, it would not matter if it did. Cormac would still see the hole in existence the man occupied. He fired 2 more shots into the man's chest, targeted his knees as he tried to spring, blew apart a hand that reached back to press against the wall. Beside Skellor, Cento unpeeled himself from metal, scissored his legs around the biophysicist's waist, and clamped them there. The golem then tore away wall panels to reveal an I-beam, which he embraced. "The cables," Cento said, calmly, overcome. Cormac loaded another clip, and, backing towards where Cento had blown out the screen, continued to pump shots into Skellor. He had to move fast. The golem would not hold Skellor for long. The clip now empty, Cormac slapped the weapon down against a stick patch at his belt, and dived through the missing screen, snagging up the APW as he went. Outside, he glanced down past the truncated ship to where the rest of it continued to fall towards the dwarf star, accompanied in its descent by the ripped-away engine pier and nacelle. Both these objects, he could see, were distorting, rippling. He found steps, hauled himself up along the curving hull, and saw 1 grapple clenched hard on wreckage where the pier had torn away, the other closed on the next nacelle. The cables were woven monofilament, hugely strong, but few materials could withstand a concentrated proton blast. High above, he saw the attack ship, blades of fusion engine flame cutting down from it to his left. He needed to hit both cables quickly before that ship fried him. Hopefully that would be enough, because if King of Hearts was like the Jack Ketch, the 2 grapples, one from each of its weapons nacelles, were all it would have ready. And by the time it readied some more, what remained of the Ogygian would be beyond its reach. Cormac stepped across to the nearest grapple, climbed up onto it, and sat down with his legs on either side of the massive cable. Should the attack ship fire at him now, it stood a good chance of destroying its own cable, a fact which might make it hesitate for long enough. Cormac aimed at the other cable, with the APW setting at its highest, and pulled the trigger. The beam transformed his target into a white-hot bar. Then it just dissolved in violet fire. Ogygian tilted underneath him as he brought the weapon to bear on the cable right next to him. Then, suddenly, he was weightless and instinctively clinging on. The second grapple had torn away, holding wreckage like a fistful of hair grasped from someone narrowly escaped. Ogygian dropped away down an invisible lift shaft to hell. Above, the cable slackened in a long arc through space, then began to straighten out again. Cormac clung on for all he was worth. When the cable tautened, about 10 G's compacted his spine down onto the grapple. The APW became too heavy to hold and tore from his grasp. He felt his vertebrae cracking and things ripping inside him, but still he clung on. Thoughts he had briefly entertained of taking action against the ship, should the cable be reeled in, died then. When the acceleration finally ceased, he coughed, spattering his visor with blood. But when he looked down, he was satisfied to see no sign of the Ogygian. The cable did then reel him in, until he was only 20 meters from the lethal ship's left-hand weapons nacelle. Ports were opening before him, annihilation a breath away.
"Now that has really pissed me off," the King of Hearts AI informed him.
Consciousness crept up on him and inserted itself into his perception. Coming out of black nothingness, Anderson slowly realized he was awake. He was lying in the lee of a slab, which was a conglomerate of fossilized worms and bivalve shells, the shape of kidneys. He reached up to ensure his skull was in one piece, found a wadded blanket supporting his head. Warily, he rolled to one side, wincing as his body informed him of its injuries, and sat upright to look around. Bonehead was a dome nearby, everything utterly retracted. Looking at the hog's damaged shell, where the saddle and lance framework had been torn away, Anderson thought he would need to make a lot of repairs with epoxy, and should not ride the hog for some time, until the shell had healed internally. Now he turned his attention to where the others stood beside what it took him a moment to identify as the fallen Droon, his lance still impaling it. He stood up a little unsteadily and walked over, noting that the brass man was gone.
"You're recovered,"
Turgle spotted him first. Anderson wondered about the tone of resentment he sensed, and recognized that Turgle had not found these latest adventures to his liking.
"As best as can be expected," Anderson replied.
Arden and Thorn now turned towards him too. He gazed past them to where the vulture perched on the wide, deflated head of the Droon. During his reading in the Library of Rondure, he had never come across the word vulture, but he recognized this creature as an uglier version of some pictures he had seen of things called birds.
"The conquering hero returns," said the vulture.
Anderson did recollect reading how some birds were good mimics, but that did not sound like mimicry to him. In fact, it sounded very like Unger Salbeck. He winced at this reminder, another complication to add to the "what now?" malaise he seemed to be suffering. "Turgle told me your trial has lasted 20 years. Arden studied him with some amusement. "And you also told me our friend here would be dragon enough." She pushed a foot against one sprawled-out limb, which looked like a twisted and torn I-beam projecting from the wreckage of some collapsed building. Anderson stepped back a pace, remembering one particular third-stage slear in a hailstorm.
"It's enough," said Anderson.
"So you'll return to Rondure?" she asked. Anderson shrugged.
"If he returned anywhere, it would be to Bravons, where Unger Salbeck awaited him. But he was not the kind of person who returned anywhere."
He glanced at Turgle.
"What do you think?"
Turgle shook his head.
"I have debts to repay, if you'll allow me."
Anderson nodded, turned to Thorn.
"What about you?"
"That remains to be decided," said Thorn. He studied the weapon he held, pulled out the empty clip and stared inside it almost accusingly before slapping it back into place. He then pointed over Anderson's shoulder. They all turned to watch the blimp approach. In utter frustration, Skellor withdrew from Cento. It was like the Occam razor, that AI burn. But he had encountered no other golem possessing the ability to destroy its own mind. He supposed Cento had prepared himself for this,
having assessed the dangers Jane Tech represented to one of his kind. Skellor pushed the golem away. No matter. He really, really had more important concerns. The brown dwarf's tidal swathe was hitting with metronomic regularity, splitting and tearing apart a Gideon all around him. Bound together by internally generated diamond fibres, and with what remained of his human nervous system shut down, Skellor tried to bend with the flow, distorted, the fibres snapping inside him, other structures breaking. But he rebuilt them, bound himself together with more fibres, and concentrated all his resources on constructing inside his torso the gravitic generator that would power him to survival. The agent probably thought he had won, thought that this was the end of Skellor. But Skellor was more than mere human. He could survive this, would survive this. The temperature was rising. Already some materials inside the ship were beginning to vaporize. The continuous grinding, twisting and flexing of the ship's structure and the rippling of its hull were generating most of the heat. Bubble metal I-beams, taking on a cherry glow, stretched like toffee and twisted apart, the inert gases used to foam their metal bleeding away into vacuum. Behind Skellor, the hull separated like wet cardboard, and underneath him the floor bowed alarmingly, then began to slough away. Everything, bar himself and one other item, was coming apart as if utterly rotten. That the golem chassis retained its shape was testament to Polity Materials technology, but even that would not survive the impact to come. The next gravity wave hit hard and lasted longer, shattering what remained of the ship across a kilometre of space. Pieces of it were now incandescent, boiling into vacuum. Skellor retained his own shape, reinforced it from inside using structural force fields powered by his internal gravitic generator. But something was wrong. That wave had nearly ripped him in two. Yet, with the theorized output of the generator, it should not have. And he would need everything the generator could give him, as there was much worse to come. He ran a diagnostic on the machine, but found it was functioning at optimum. Separate from his internal diagnostics, he probed inside it with nanoptic fibers and located the node, growing right in the center of it. He opened the generator, forced the node out, closed the generator, and had it up to 40% of function when the next wave hit. Skellor screamed, mostly in rage and frustration, now a piece of diamond-sewn meat stretched out over 4 meters of nothing. Tidal forces had shredded the remains of the ship, the bulk of it now a falling arc of metallic vapour. Skellor was the largest single chunk remaining, the second largest being an eyeless golem skull. He slowly drew himself back together, high above an endless brown plain, became a black human doll full of whirls and knots, witch-fingered. Much of his substance had been torn away or had boiled into vacuum, and his mind was losing cohesion. Before it went completely, simple physics impinged. He could not survive this. How had he ever thought he could survive this? Some hours later, a fibrous mass containing Jane eggs, which so far had managed to retain their shape, hit the surface. Half that mass turned to energy. All that remained was a baroque silver pattern across the dun surface. Through tunneling vision, Cormac watched as out of an elliptical port on the side of the nacelle, at the end of a jointed arm, extruded a close-quarters laser. This device looked something like a pre-millennial machine gun, though rather than belt-fed with ammunition, it was fed by thick, ribbed power cables. But it served the same purpose, normally being used against smaller opponents who had actually managed to get close to the ship's hull. It was, precisely, the weapon required to remove Cormac from the grapple, probably in pieces. He spat blood and looked aside, still seeing into the tear in his perception. Perhaps he could step inside the ship, cause damage. Something. No. The whole idea was laughable now. He had done it. He had shifted himself through U-space by an act of will. But right then he had no idea of how he had done it. And what could he do inside the ship, injured and weak as he was? Reality was himself, suspended in vacuum, with a laser pointed at him and death imminent. Then, through that same tear in vision, something surfaced, distantly. Something huge. "I see," said King. The laser powered up, a hot glow emitting from its sooty workings. It turned on its arm and fired. The cable glowed red, white, blue, white. Then the center of that light exploded into globules of molten carbon. Once again, Cormac was weightless, as the grapple and a short piece of the cable he was clinging to began to fall back towards the brown dwarf. The laser folded away, all ports closed, and the attack ship receded above him. "You saw that I did not gain access to Skellor or to Jayne technology," King said. "So," Cormac managed. "Tell Jerusalem that." As he fell, Cormac faded. Even the perceptile programs he had been using were not managing to keep him conscious. He saw a vision of curving steel, thought himself near impact with the dwarf star, but realized that was wrong. If he was that close, he would not see a curve to the horizon, would probably see nothing at all. Then something titanic engulfed him, and claws, three-fingered and gleaming, closed on his upper arms. As they separated him from the cable, things ripped inside his body. Blood exploded from his mouth, and something hard entered his neck. After a numb hiatus, which he read in his gridlink as having lasted 7 minutes, came bright, aseptic light. "This may take some time," said the voice of Acellus Mika. "I don't think there's an unbroken bone in his body." Another voice, the resonant iceberg tip of vast intellect, noted, "The inside of his head is not much better." The lights went out again. When humans referred to something called a cold sweat, Dragon had formerly known what it meant only on an intellectual level. Now the entity understood what it meant on a visceral level. In its dealings with the polity, it had always purposely encountered lesser entities than itself. This was why it had always kept away from the larger capacity runcible AIs, sector AIs, and tried not to operate within 20 light years of any place in which Earth Central had shown the slightest interest. Jerusalem was precisely the kind of polity AI the Dragon had therefore always avoided. Now the entity was reminded why.
for Jerusalem possessed the sheer mental power to beat Dragon at its own games, whilst also inhabiting a ship body possessing the physical size and power to render it unnecessary for it to play such games. This was why Dragon had found itself unable to conceal certain facts for very long. The essence of the transmission after the initial fencing had been, "Tell me everything, and fast," along with the blueprint of one of the Jerusalem's internal chambers and an overview of the equipment that could be used there. Dragon was left in no doubt that the ship could encompass, immobilize, then dismantle it to see how it ticked. That the Jerusalem had dropped into U-space upon learning about the Egidian was less than reassuring. It meant the AI certainly knew that Dragon would not be escaping and could be dealt with at leisure. The thought of such an AI gaining access to Skellor was frightening. The thought of it obtaining certain items that Skellor would soon be shedding, like a dandelion scattering its seeds in the breeze, was enough to give even a dragon nightmares. But Dragon had no power to affect those events. Though one such item, close by, it had aimed to put in safer hands. Still on course for Kull, the entity linked through to the flying lizard, which had coiled up to sleep in a sulabane leaf, the recent stress of expected extinction having obviously exhausted it. Receiving instruction, the creature reared up, shook itself, and flew over to the carapace remains of Skellor's last meal on Kull, landed and looked to where the golden egg had fallen. Dragon was so amused it decided to let the lizard live, despite its near contact with Jane technology. Where the egg had lain in the dust, now rested a blue acorn. Dragon wondered what the brass man would make of his new toy. Others might wonder at the entity's definition of safer hands. Epilogue. Fethan stooped down by the dismembered golem and thought, with morbid humour, "I don't hold out much hope for his recovery." But in this case, that might not be true. Gant may have been missing one leg and his head, but memory crystal should contain his essential being inside his golem chest. However, Jane growth marred that chest, and the golem had shut down. What this growth might portend was why Fethan and Thorn had insisted on searching alone, and why they had allowed Tanaquil and the boy Turgle to return to Golgoth in the blimp. Fethan contemplated that. The chief Metalier's cry of anger on realizing that the colony ship Egidian no longer occupied the sky had been heart-wrenching. Seeing that his one contact with that human civilization he craved to return to had taken his wife and his dreams. Perhaps he might dream new dreams? Certainly, the polity was not finished with this world. "Are you getting anything?" Thorn asked. Fethan shook his head. "I haven't tried yet." Now he did attempt to make contact through Gant's internal radio. Perhaps the dead soldier's only remaining link to the outside world. But, as before, he found there something vicious that made him jerk away. It was like placing his hand in a dark burrow and hearing some animal snarl. Viral subversion then tracked his signal back, alien Jane code. He shut down his transceiver and isolated it,
killing the power to his primary decoder as well.
"I don't think he's in there," he said.
"We have to be sure," Thorne said. Fethan shrugged. He liked Gant and had no wish for him to be irrevocably dead, but he had not known the man or the machine for as long as Thorne had. Reluctantly, he sent an internal signal and detached the synth flesh covering of his fingertip. Then, studying Gant's neck, he discounted all the severed optics, selecting instead a small duct containing hair-thin superconducting filaments. He pressed his fingertip against the break. Through nerve linkages in his fingertip, the kill program made connections and found its way through to the golem's crystal storage. The program did not transcribe this time, as it only needed to look. Fethan felt an ache growing in his right shoulder and arm. Psychosomatic it might be, but it still bothered him. Finally, the program made its assessment.
"Your friend is gone. There is nothing recognizably human in here. Only Jane code and its need to survive and spread."
At that moment, the golem's hands came up, tracked up Fethan's arm by touch, and closed on his throat. But this availed it nothing, for the old cyborg's throat was hard. He caught both wrists and pushed the groping hands away, propelling himself rapidly backwards.
"Gant is gone," he said.
With a metallic crunching, the golem body folded back on itself, then arched up and thrust itself towards Fethan. This, more than anything, confirmed the program's diagnosis, for the Jane inside was forcing the golem body into something tripodal, something with no physical relation at all to the human race. Thorne immediately swung Fethan's APW to bear and opened fire. The three-limbed beast bounced in red flame. Synth flesh burning away, it hopped and bounced like a spider in a lighter flame. Thorne hit it again and again. Limbs came away until eventually it was still. Thorne then approached the broken torso, and drawing a knife he had acquired aboard the blimp, probed inside and at last levered out the lozenge of Gant's erstwhile mind.
"What are you going to do?" Fethan asked.
Thorne did not reply. He placed the mind on a rock, brought the butt of his weapon hard down on it. Then, perhaps remembering Mr. Crane, he ground the fragments to dust and scattered it. "We'll leave the rest for the clear-up crews," said Thorne. "They'll be all over this place soon. Let's head back to the city."
"Yes,"
thought Fethan, realizing he would not himself be leaving any time soon. Tanaquil will be needing some help during the time to come. The sun was setting in a greenish explosion, and occasional stars beginning to brave the firmament. His armour stripped off and hanging, along with his other belongings, on temporary pegs, epoxied to the side of Bonehead's carapace, Anderson Endrick trudged towards a new horizon. His legs were aching from this unaccustomed exercise, but he would get used to it. It wasn't as if he was old or anything. He had just gone a few rounds with one of the fiercest creatures on this planet. However, he was averse to stopping again, no matter how entitled he was to rest. It was difficult pretending not to notice how, each time he did stop, the sandhog extruded its sensory head to observe him and tapped a little tattoo on the ground with the tip of one crawler limb. The devastation of broken rock on the draconic plateau was far behind, which was annoying as it now took him a little while to spot a suitable rock on which to sit.
When he did see one, he sank down with a sigh, his back towards Bonehead, then used a cloth to mop the sweat from his bald pate. It was a shame about Turgle leaving. Once over his criminal tendencies, the boy had shown promise. But Turgle had claimed he still had issues to resolve with his stepfather and mother. This was good, as it meant the boy was back on track, and Anderson was not going to stand in his way, even though he felt the youth's departure was only partially about that. Turgle had lost his sense of fun while the Droon had hunted them, and then lost heart when it had killed Stone. Anderson guessed that travelling by blimp, Turgle and the others would be halfway back to Golgoth by now. Had Anderson chosen to accompany them, he himself could have been perhaps a quarter of the way back towards Braavos. He had not so chosen. After taking a sip from his water bottle, Anderson asked of his travelling companion, "How far again?" Seated on her rucksack, Arden glanced across at him. 5,000 kilometres. "And then you'll take this ship up and go to this polity?"
"Certainly, unless I encounter somewhere more interesting before I reach it."
Arden shrugged. "Room for a sand hog on this ship?"
"I'm sure we can manage something.
That's if Bonehead wants to come." "Well, he can decide when we get there, and that'll be a while yet."
Anderson stared up at the sky and saw that it was not only ribbons of cloud and the odd star that occupied it now.
"And you?" Arden asked.
Anderson heaved himself to his feet, pointed above his head.
"Oh, I've already decided. My world just got a lot larger."
Tanaquil carefully read the lengthy report from Stoller. A great deal of advanced technology had become available to them from the landing craft, computing power, components they were yet unable to manufacture, and systems they could directly copy rather than reconstruct from ancient schematics. 5 craft were quite probably still operational, though it would take them some time to learn how to operate them, and perhaps one more could be constructed from the other damaged ones. But in the end, to what purpose now? Ogygian was gone. A dream had been destroyed.
"Jilin is dead."
Tanaquil rested his face in his palms.
"Now, maybe, that dream was no longer needed. 2 citizens from this human polity were out there somewhere in the sand towers, and that polity now knew about this world." Stoller was quite enthusiastic about this, but Tanaquil could find no enthusiasm inside himself, no room for hope. Perhaps that was because he resented Stoller, who had miraculously survived a fall similar to the one that had killed Jilin. He took his hands away from his face before reaching out, turning on his desk lamp, then opening another report. His eyes remained dry. Gyrol had organized a guard for those burying the dead, because Sleer activity had meanwhile increased tenfold. A great deal of wreckage had been cleared from the spot where a lander had crashed into the lower city, and those that required shelter had been housed in warehouses in the industrial district. Medical teams were working night and day to disinfect and sew shut the head wounds nearly every citizen bore. They would recover, regroup, and then, the human polity? Tanaquil shook his head as if to dispel shadows. Everything was black,
Depression constricted his mind and sapped his strength, his will. The excitement that was now displacing shock in the likes of Stoller and Gyril seemed utterly inaccessible to him. He would just do his job. Keep going. There wasn't anything else. Then a knock at his door broke his reverie. "Who is it?" he asked.
"Stoller and Gyril," replied Stoller, some tension clear in his voice. "Come in."
The two men entered, Stoller resting heavily on a cane, Gyril still in his kilnsman gear and lugging one of the small telescopes and a tripod from Stoller's tower. Stoller looked around the dark room, focused on the shutters pulled across the windows and the closed balcony doors. He glanced meaningfully at Gyril as he pointed at these.
"What is it?" "I've got a lot to do," said Tanaquil.
"You haven't seen?" "No, obviously not." "Perhaps we should step out onto your balcony," Stoller replied.
Tanaquil didn't want them here. He wanted to be alone with his thoughts, but something in both of their expressions pulled him to his feet. Stoller moved over to the balcony doors, unlatched and pulled them open. Perhaps some new collapse in the lower city? Tanaquil dared not think otherwise. He stepped out into the dark after the old man, Gyril following close behind and stepping to one side to set up the telescope. Tanaquil surveyed his city, seeing only the fires being fed by those horrible grey lice things.
"Look up, Chief Metallier," said Stoller.
Tanaquil did as instructed. A telescope was hardly required. Bright leviathans filled the sky, immense ships that would have dwarfed Ogygium. One vast ship, almost like a steel moon, hung clearly in view. Smaller ships were jetting in between. Other ships, smaller still but seeming large because they loomed so close, were coming down. Tanaquil gaped, felt the blackness around him dispersing under the impact of this vision, something breaking in his chest. He bowed his head and felt it coming. Felt Stoller's hand momentarily on his shoulder before he and Gyril returned inside to give him space. He moved forwards and rested his hands on the rail as grief heaved out of him. He did not know how long this lasted. One of the ships, a thing consisting of four spheres mounted at the end of star arms, drifted over the city, its correction jet flames stabbing out. Tanaquil reached up and touched the tears pouring down his face, then wiped them away. The pain was still there. He doubted it would ever go away completely. He returned inside, to where Stoller and Gyril waited.
"Our world is going to change drastically," he said. "But we will not allow that change to swamp us, to erase what we have done or what we are. We have work to do. So, let's begin."
It was virtuality, illusion, for no projector could get close. And what point would there be in projecting holograms to that place anyway? But there was a point to this. Jack felt there was a point. Perhaps he was too much of an aesthete. Perhaps there was too much conceit in this. And just maybe Dragon owned that same conceit as much as himself and Afrin. Whatever. Jack and the erstwhile separatist walked on the surface of the brown dwarf. Dragon, who had rescued them just before they departed the Kull system, but seemed reluctant to give them up to Jerusalem or any of the other polity AIs patrolling this still enclosed sector of space, seemed not to be present at all.
granting them this illusory space and a definite moment of satisfaction.
"He makes a pretty pattern," said Afrin, eyeing the silvery spirals and ellipses inlaid in the super-dense surface.
"He does that, and it is a pattern that is changing."
"What?"
Afrin looked up. Jack pointed.
"Those ellipses are compressed Jane nodes. They won't change, apparently, unless removed from this environment. They require a host and a motivating will. The rest is him, still trying to survive, still trying to return himself to order."
"He's alive, he thinks?"
"In a sense, and slowly."
"Will he get away from here?"
Jack allowed himself a hangman's smile.
"Not in the lifetime of this universe."
A golden egg, clasped in one brass hand, Mr. Crane walked the dusty plateau, shady canyons, and ragged mountain chains of Kull. Like a knight who slew a dragon, he slid from cold reality into bar yarn, and very quickly into legend. Those who saw that tall, striding figure wearing a wide-brimmed hat, and with the bottom of his long, ragged coat flapping about his lace-up boots, often agreed that a flying creature accompanied him. One much like some seen in the spaceport being built just outside Golgoth. Perhaps they thought this extra touch added veracity to their assertion that they had actually seen Mr. Crane. Others pretended to believe these witnesses with the same patronizing kindness with which they believed those who claimed to have seen the inconstant sea. What they had seen was real. Sort of. In a sense.
This was an audio production of Brass Man by Neil Asher, read by Rick Jerram. Published by Macmillan Digital Audio, an imprint of Pan Macmillan, a division of Macmillan Publishers Limited. Text copyright, Neil Asher, 2005. Recording copyright, Macmillan Digital Audio, 2017. The right of Neil Asher to be identified as the author of this work has been asserted by him in accordance with the Copyright, Designs and Patents Act 1988, all rights reserved. Produced by Strathmore Publishing, directed by Alec Reed, and recorded at Chatterbox Audio.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.